All right, so I was talking about fluorescence, which would not be a good thing for photosynthesis because it would waste the energy of the sunlight, right? All fluorescence does is transform the energy from one photon, which gets destroyed by being absorbed, into the energy of a new photon that gets emitted. This is why signs with fluorescent paints, like speed limit signs, are so bright. They're actually shining light at you because the light you shine on them gets absorbed. It excites the paint, and then it shines light back to you. That wouldn't work for photosynthesis. So the way that chlorophyll works in a plant is not the way it works just as isolated molecules in solution, which will fluoresce if you shine light on them. Instead, the pigment molecules in a plant are complexed with a bunch of proteins and other molecules in what we call photosystem complexes. A photosystem complex is shown on slide 8, and there are many, many photosystem complexes in a chlorophyll, specifically in the thylakoid membrane of a chlorophyll. This just shows you a model of one complex. So a photosystem complex consists of many different proteins, plus a bunch of other molecules, including pigment molecules, both chlorophyll and A and B, as well as accessory pigments. And as far as structure is concerned, a photosystem complex consists of a reaction center, and then surrounding that reaction center are several light harvesting complexes, which is shown in cartoon form in part B here. So you have a reaction center illustrated by this green disc, or the dark green disc, and the lighter ones around it are the light harvesting complexes. So all the light harvesting complexes have pigment molecules in them, whether it's chlorophyll or accessory pigments. They are acting like little antennas. They absorb photons. Photons are coming in just from sunlight, and they're randomly hitting these various light harvesting complexes. Well, the photons that actually get absorbed, not all of them do, of course, some of them just pass right through because they don't actually hit a pigment molecule. But the photons that actually do get absorbed by a pigment excite that pigment, of course, like I was saying, just like it does in fluorescence. Except when the excited pigment molecule, meaning that its electron is sent up an energy level, when that electron goes back down, a photon is not created. It's not fluorescence. Instead, that release of energy represented by that falling of the electron back down an energy level actually excites a nearby pigment molecule in a process called resonance energy transfer. We're not going to get into the physical details of how that happens, but just rest assured that it does happen. So, in other words, an excited pigment molecule, after having been excited, is able then to excite a neighbor pigment molecule. And no additional photon is created. And so the second one that's excited by the first is not excited by a photon, it's excited by the excitation of the first pigment. And it's therefore the excitation that gets sent from one light harvesting complex to another, represented by the red arrows here, until finally the reaction center complex, which is at the core of the photosystem complex, gets excited. Specifically, a special pair of chlorophyll A molecules in there, which are called the special pair, get excited by resonance energy transfer. Okay? Now, the reason this is a special pair is because when that special pair gets excited, it really gets very excited, in a sense. Not only is the electron sent up an energy level, but it gets so excited that the electron actually leaves that molecule. In other words, that reaction center gets oxidized, right? Because its electrons are being removed from it. And so, of course, if it's being oxidized, something else gets reduced. So, as a result of the original photon coming in and causing the excitation in the light harvesting complexes, the reaction center gets oxidized, sending its electron to something else that gets reduced. That something else is an electron acceptor, by definition, right? And that's all we'll call it, because the details, the fine details aren't the important thing here. Okay, so the electron acceptor gets reduced, and it's carrying energy now, energy that used to be in sunlight, right? Something that's reduced is more energetic, just like the reduced form of the coenzymes we've been talking about, right? That's carrying energy. Well, so is this thing that received electrons from the reaction center complex in response to sunlight originally. This is the mechanism by which the energy of sunlight gets captured for useful work in photosynthesis. Now, the useful work ultimately is the production of trioses, right? Organic molecules, 3-carbon sugars. But immediately the energy is being put into this electron acceptor. All right, that's how a photosystem works in general. Now, I said there are thousands and thousands of copies of photosystems, but there are two categories of photosystems. Let me go to slide 9 now. And these photosystems are called photosystem 2 and photosystem 1. Now, I mention them in reverse order because that's the order in which they operate. Photosystem 2 operates first, and then photosystem 1 operates. And the only reason it's that way is because these things were named for the order in which they were discovered, and they just happened to discover the one that operates second in line first, so they called it photosystem 1. All right, so don't be confused by that. Photosystem 2 operates first. It's the one that's on the left side of this figure, as you see, photosystem 1 on the right side. These are Roman numerals that you use for photosystems. So there's many copies of each type, but photosystem 2, a photosystem 2 and a photosystem 1 cooperate in the process, the overall first phase of photosynthesis, which is the energy transduction phase, right? Or the light-dependent reactions. That's what the photosystems operate in. Now, P680 is just a nickname for photosystem 2 because it has its chlorophylls, it as a photosystem has an optimal absorbance wavelength of 680 nanometers, whereas photosystem 1 is nicknamed P700. Its optimal wavelength for absorption is a little bit higher. Okay? But the point here is what's happening with them cooperating. So notice there's a photon coming in from sunlight, little packet of energy, of light energy, and it gets absorbed by photosystem 2. By resonance energy transfer, because the photon no longer exists after it's absorbed, by resonance energy transfer, that excitation eventually reaches the reaction center of photosystem 2. And that special pair gets so excited that it actually loses the electron, which is represented by the upward red line here, this red arrow. So P680 star refers to the oxidized reaction center because it has lost its electron. It passes it on to pheophyton, but that's the one I was trying to avoid even naming because I just called it an electron acceptor, okay? The chlorophyll in the reaction center complex does not like not having an electron. So as soon as it loses an electron, it really very much wants an electron back. It's not going to get that electron back, though, which would be worthless to the plant in terms of processing the energy. But there needs to be a replacement electron that gets immediately sent to that reaction center that just lost an electron. Now, does anyone know the source of that electron? Yes, water is the source. Remember, water is a reactant in the summary reaction for photosynthesis, not a product like it is in cellular respiration. Well, water is required by plants, I mean, for various reasons. Water is required by all living things. But photosynthetically, water is required because it gets enzymatically split to use the hydrogen atoms of that water as a source for electrons and protons. All right, the electrons from the hydrogens that get split from oxygen when water gets split will replace the electrons that get lost from the reaction center of photosystem 2. And when you do that, you also produce protons, right? Electrons and protons are the hydrogens. What's left over, though, besides that, is oxygen atoms, which combine to form O2. This is why plants spit out O2 via photosynthesis. All right? The O2 is, remember, you should think of oxygen as the oxidized form of water, or you should think of water as the reduced form of oxygen, right? We reduce oxygen in cellular respiration to produce water because it receives the electrons at the end of the chain. Here we're doing the reverse. We're oxidizing water to get electrons, and the result is the oxidized form of water, which is oxygen. All right? Now, let's go back to the electron that... Let's go to photosystem 1 now. Meanwhile, photosystem 1, which is the second one to operate, it is being inundated with photons also. So this separate photon is striking one of the pigment molecules in the light harvesting complexes of photosystem 1. All right, totally different occurrence here. And the same thing happens there. The photon, if it's lucky enough to hit one of the pigments, it gets absorbed. The photon no longer exists. The excitation passes via resonance energy transfer to the reaction center of photosystem 1, and it will lose its electron as well. It becomes oxidized, sends it to a different electron acceptor, which is actually a special molecule of chlorophyll A, but just in general, these things that receive the electrons from the reaction center complexes, you can think of as electron acceptors. All right, so the same thing is happening in photosystem 1, but when it greedily asks for an electron to replace the one that was just lost, the source of its electron is not water immediately. The source of its electron that replaces the one that was just lost is the electron that got lost from photosystem 2. Okay? Notice that joining these two photosystems in the middle is a complex of proteins and other molecules acting as an electron transport chain. Okay, so there's an electron transport chain that functionally and structurally joins the photosystems, the two photosystem types, 2 and 1. Okay, so the electron that gets lost from the reaction center of photosystem 2 gets passed from member to member of that electron transport chain in the middle and then replaces a different electron that just got removed from photosystem 1 by excitation from a separate photon. It will satisfy that reaction center of photosystem 1, right? The electron that comes down the electron transport chain replaces the one that's lost from photosystem 1. Now, the electron that's lost from photosystem 1 will then get passed, eventually, after a few things take it along the way, eventually it will get passed to NADP+ to make NADPH. Now, of course, it's not just electrons, it's protons are involved as well. Okay? Now, just like in the electron transport process for cellular respiration occurring in the mitochondrion, the effect of the stepwise loss of energy as those electrons get transferred is to pump protons, right? So electron transport allows for the conversion of energy into the form of a gradient. Same thing is happening here. The electron transport chain between the two photosystems is not identical, but very, very similar to the mitochondrial electron transport chain. And this cytochrome B6/F complex, which is just part of the electron transport chain in photosynthesis, is a special part because it's the part that operates as a proton pump. We talked about complexes 1, 3, and 4 in cellular respiration acting as pump. Well, this acts as a pump as well. For the same reason, it's powered by the transfer of electrons, which releases energy a little bit at a time. So just like in cellular respiration, the pumping of protons creates a gradient that is used for the chemiosmotic diffusion of hydrogen ions back through the membrane through ATP synthase molecules. So it's also, not only does it create the gradient the same way pretty much, but the gradient is used for the same purpose, to create ATP molecules. Well, remember last time that we said the goal, in a sense, of the whole light reactions, or the energy transduction reactions, is to produce the two energy-carrying molecules required for the second phase of cellular respiration. Calvin cycle requires two energy-carrying molecules, two types, right? ATP and NADPH. Well, the proton gradient, it allows for the creation of ATP using ATP synthase molecules. The ATP synthase isn't shown here, but it's also in that thylakoid membrane, just like it's also in the inner membrane of the mitochondrion. All right? At the end of the line, though, the ultimate receiver of these electrons that came from water originally, after trickling through the electron transport chain in both photosystems, the ultimate receiver of these electrons is NADP+. So you not only make ATP via the electron transport chain in the middle, you also make NADPH, the other energy-carrying molecule that the Calvin cycle or the light-independent reactions requires. That all make sense? Well, if we look at slide 10, we can see this in more of a structural form, looking at the thylakoid membrane of the chloroplast in detail. So this is just one copy of photosystem 2, one copy of photosystem 1. The electron transport chain are members of the membrane as well, occurring between the two photosystems. And you also have an ATP synthase molecule in purple on the right. Okay? Photons are coming in, striking both photosystems. Photosystem 2 gets excited. That sends an electron to the electron transport chain. To immediately replace that electron, water gets split, using hydrogen atoms of the water as a source for the electrons to replace them, and the leftover is oxygen. Go ahead.
ATP synthase complexes both work similarly?
Yeah, they're not only similar, they're almost identical. So they work exactly the same way. They only turn if hydrogen ions are coming through them. So think of them as being identical, even though molecularly they are not actually identical. They just work exactly the same way. Okay, so we're feeding electrons to the electron transport chain, which involves energizing those electrons, right? You wouldn't be able to send electrons to the electron transport chain without increasing the energy. So importantly, the source of that energy is the sunlight. Without the sunlight, the electrons would not have the energy to be put high on the graph, as that last slide was. It was also a graph, so you wouldn't have the energy to feed it to the electron transport chain if the photon doesn't excite it to begin with. So that's where the energy gets transduced. It's electromagnetic energy or sunlight, light energy first. It gets transduced into the form of reduced NADPH, reduced coenzyme. To transduce means to change from one energy form to another. Like a loudspeaker, for instance, is a transducer because it transduces electrical energy into mechanical energy when it magnetically makes the cone move in and out. Right? So that's why these are called the energy transduction reactions. Transduces light energy into energy of reduced coenzymes. But anyway, that's what photosystem 2 does. It feeds the electron transport chain and it gets replenished of its electrons via water directly. Meanwhile, photosystem 1 receives photons, get absorbed. That excites its own electrons, which get then passed to NADP plus to produce NADPH. Okay? And what immediately replenishes those electrons are the electrons that come from photosystem 2 and trickle through the electron transport chain. So all the electrons get replaced by water, but it depends on whether it's mediate or immediate, right? The electron transport chain's operation, though, produces, because of the pumping of protons, ATP via the operation of ATP synthase molecules. So that there you have the two goals being met of the energy transduction reactions. You make NADPH, you make ATP, both of which are required to actually build the sugar, which happens in the second phase of photosynthesis, the Calvin cycle, or the light independent reactions. Okay, now, if you run all of this as I've said, then what you make is an equal amount of ATP and NADPH. They're made in a ratio of 1:1, equal amounts of both. But, as we'll see, the Calvin cycle, which is the second major phase, that's when the sugar gets built, does not, even though it requires both types of energy-carrying molecules, it doesn't require them in equal amounts. And so there has to be a way to make up for the fact that ATP and NADPH are not needed in equal amounts. The Calvin cycle needs more ATP than NADPH. It needs, for every 3 ATP, it only needs 2 NADPH. Okay, so it's a 3-2 ratio. Well, if you ran both photosystems the way I said, you could look at it either as you're making too much NADPH or you're not making enough ATP. They're really the same thing, right? Because you need to make them in a 3-2 ratio, not a 1-1 ratio. And therefore, any given pair of photosystems, because they're all operating as a pair, 2 and 1 together, can switch back and forth between what's called non-cyclic electron flow and cyclic electron flow. What I've already described, which uses both photosystems, is called non-cyclic electron flow because electrons flow unidirectionally or non-cyclically from water originally through both photosystems to NADP plus to make it into NADPH. All right? That produces both kinds of energy-carrying molecules, just in the wrong ratio. So, in what we have in slide 11 is a representation of cyclic electron flow. And in cyclic electron flow, there's only one photosystem being used here. And what happens is that the electrons get cycled through the electron transport chain and then just right back to the photo system rather than going on to NADPH. Notice this X here is blocking this. So electrons trickle to photosystem 1 down the electron transport chain, just as I've described. That gets excited, but then instead of sending that electron to NADP+, that electron gets, which is now excited because of that photon in photosystem 1, gets just sent back to the electron transport chain for another trip through the electron transport chain. So let me go back to slide 9 for a second. Cyclic electron transport would be this second electron being excited in photosystem 1. Instead of going this way to NADP+, would just come back here and go to the electron transport chain for another trip around. All right? That's what's being represented, even though it doesn't match up perfectly shape-wise, in slide 11. So notice that since the NADP plus is not receiving these electrons, no NADPH is being produced. But since you're sending this excited electron back to the electron transport chain, you're pumping additional protons and therefore allowing for the phosphorylation of more ADP into ATP. So cyclic electron flow produces ATP without producing any NADPH. And therefore, if some pairs of photosystems are employing cyclic electron flow and other pairs are doing non-cyclic electron flow, then you're producing exactly the right ratio of ATP to NADPH that the Calvin cycle is going to require. And how does it know? Well, it's simple feedback. If you have non-cyclic electron flow occurring, that's really the same thing as producing too much NADPH, right? Because you're producing just as much as you're producing ATP. Well, if you produce too much NADPH, meaning some of it's not being used, that means your fleet of NADPs, the taxis, are in their full form, their reduced form. There aren't any NADP pluses available if you have all full taxis. It's all in the reduced form, right? And if there aren't any NADP pluses, empty taxis, then they simply can't receive the electrons that come from photosystem 1. And therefore, the only place those electrons can go is back to the electron transport chain automatically. That's how it knows, in a sense, to switch. As soon as the NADP plus the NADPH that's on hand already starts being used in the Calvin cycle, that's going to free up some taxis, NADP pluses, which will now accept electrons, and that will automatically switch it back over to non-cyclic electron flow. Now, does all that make sense? Okay, so you end up assuming that the ATP is not used for the various other things that it can be used for, you end up making 3 ATP to every 2 NADPHs, which is exactly right for the Calvin cycle. Well, speaking of witches, let's look at the Calvin cycle, slide 12. It's the first of two slides that show you the same cycle, but this one is the condensed version. It doesn't show you all the details. It shows you the important parts, though, as far as what's trying to be accomplished here. The structural formulae are not shown, and not all the intermediates are shown, but it shows you the number of carbons that are in each of these important intermediates. The Calvin cycle has three major aspects to it, three phases. Since their phases happen in order, the first of these is a carboxylation phase. Now, not decarboxylation, carboxylation, right? That means sticking a CO2 onto something else. Well, the carboxylation phase is, of course, when CO2 is required, right? This is why CO2 is also on the left side of the summary reaction for photosynthesis. CO2 and water are the two requirements. Water was required for a source of electrons in the light-dependent reactions. CO2 is required as a source of carbons for carbon skeletons of organic compounds. CO2 is not organic, but we're going to use the carbon in CO2 to make an organic compound. What is that process in general called?
Carbon fixation.
So this carboxylation phase of the Calvin cycle could also be called a carbon fixation phase. That's when carbon actually gets fixed. So we're going from CO2, which is inorganic, to an organic molecule. Well, to do that, you need an organic compound already that receives this additional carbon to make it just a bigger organic compound. That organic compound is a 5-carbon substance. And it's called ribulose 1,5-bisphosphate because there are 2 phosphates hanging off it as well. Okay? Ribulose, you might recognize, is a pentose. Okay? So that's why it's showing you with 5 carbons in each one of them, 2 phosphates in each one of them. There's 3 of these things that are going to receive individually an additional carbon from carbon dioxide. So 3 carbon dioxides are being used here, 1 for each of the 3 ribulose 1,5-bisphosphates. That carboxylation phase is going to then turn a 5-carbon compound into a 6-carbon compound. But notice that there's no 6-carbon compound shown here. And that's because it never really exists in isolation. We can't detect it because it only lasts as a transition step in a catalyzed reaction. What I mean here is that, yes, the carbon dioxide's carbon does join with the 5 of ribulose bisphosphate to form a 6-carbon intermediate, but that intermediate immediately, even before it gets released by the enzyme, gets hydrolyzed or split into 2 3-carbon compounds, which are called 3-phosphoglycerate. Okay? So if this is happening to 3 ribulose bisphosphates using 3 carbon dioxides to add a carbon to each of these, you're going to have a total of 18 carbons you're working with, right? You have those 18s transiently as 3 6-carbon compounds, which immediately get split into 6 3-carbon compounds. Those are the 3-phosphoglycerates. Now, do you remember where you've learned about 3-phosphoglycerate already? Where was it? Not in respiration. Glycolysis, yes. And so the next phase of the Calvin cycle really effectively is the reverse of some of the steps in glycolysis. And the second phase is a reduction phase, which makes sense, right? Because the reduction is the opposite of what? Oxidation, and glycolysis featured oxidations, right? If you go back and look at glycolysis, you'll see that glyceraldehyde 3-phosphate, which is at the fork in the road, gets oxidized stepwise into 3-phosphoglycerate. Here instead, we're going to reduce 3-phosphoglycerate into glyceraldehyde 3-phosphate. So instead of producing ATP like glycolysis does, we're going to require ATP. And instead of, I shouldn't have said reducing. I mean, instead of, no, I said produce, right, not reduce. And instead of reducing NAD plus into NADH like in glycolysis, photosynthesis is going to oxidize NADPH into NADP+. So, really, it's just the reverse of a few of those glycolytic reactions. But that is represented from the 12 o'clock position to about the 5 o'clock position right here. That's the reductive part. And notice that ATP and NADPH are both required there. As I said, it requires both kinds. The final phase, the third phase of the Calvin cycle, is just the regeneration of the carbon dioxide receptor, or acceptor, I should say. Ribulose 1,5-bisphosphate is the carbon dioxide acceptor, because it's the thing that gets carboxylated at the beginning. You have to have that stuff in order for the cycle to continue. Well, it gets used up. I mean, it's when you transform it into 3-phosphoglycerate, it's no longer ribulose bisphosphate. So you need to make up for what you are transforming in order for it to continue. That's what the final phase is. A rearrangement of the carbon skeleton so that you have that ribulose 1,5-bisphosphate again to accept more carbon dioxide. Now, notice that part of that also requires ATP. So 3 ATP are used here, 6 up here. That's 9 ATP. You use 6 NADPH. That's a 3-to-2 ratio, like I was saying. All right. The one thing I haven't mentioned here, though, is that when you make these 6 glyceraldehyde 3-phosphate molecules, 5 of them will go on in the cycle, but 1 out of every 6 that's produced by the spinning of the cycle gets driven off of the cycle. So the glyceraldehyde 3-phosphate, or G3P as it's nicknamed, that is the triose phosphate that is the direct product of photosynthesis. It's not glucose, remember. I said that when we write the summary reaction for photosynthesis, we usually write it as the reverse of the oxidation of glucose, but really photosynthesis ends. You can make glucose out of G3P, or two G3Ps. You can form glucose out of that, but what photosynthesis directly produces as its sugars and as its organic compounds are molecules of G3P, glyceraldehyde 3-phosphate. Okay? The rest of the 5, which represents 15 total carbon atoms, because there's 3 in each, those get rearranged into 3 5 carbon compounds, ribulose, bisphosphate, which are the carbon dioxide acceptors. All right, let's just look at it in greater detail in slide 13. I don't want you to memorize all these intermediates, their structural formulae, but I just want you to appreciate what's going on here. The 3-phosphoglycerate to 1,3-bisphosphoglycerate to glyceraldehyde 3-phosphate, those are the reactions that you'll find in glycolysis that are just being reversed, really, in the citric acid cycle. What else did I want to say about this? Just keep in mind that it takes several cycles through the Calvin cycle to actually get enough triose phosphates that you can spit one off for every 6. Okay? Because 5 of those 6 need to go back into continuing the cycle. That's the major point here. But you keep running it and you'll make triose phosphates. Now, I don't want to talk about all the individual enzymes, but I do want to talk about a very special enzyme, which is the one that is responsible for the carboxylation step. It's the one that fixes carbon. And that is the enzyme that allows for the ribulose bisphosphate to receive an additional carbon to transform it after that transient product is split into 3-phosphoglycerate. And that enzyme has a nickname, which is Rubisco, which is cap, since it's an acronym, is really should be capital R U, capital B I S, capital C, capital O. But usually it's not written that way. The reason I want to say it that way is because Rubisco is an acronym or a nickname for ribulose bisphosphate carboxylase oxygenase, which is listed right here. Now notice that there are two words in that long name that have A's as the as an ending. The enzyme ending is A-S-E, right? So ribulose, bisphosphatase, carboxylase, and oxygenase is two kinds of enzymes in one, really. Or it's an enzyme that operates potentially as either of two types of enzymes, I should say. It's not that it has two active sites. So that active site can let it operate as a carboxylase, which is why it's part of its name, or as an oxygenase. Now the plant wants it to operate as a carboxylase. In other words, you want carbon dioxide to come in there as the reactant or the substrate so that you're adding an additional carbon, right? The whole idea is to fix carbon into an organic compound. But oxygen also works instead of carbon dioxide, in which case you're not increasing the amount of carbon in the skeleton, right? You're not fixing any additional carbon if oxygen gets in there instead. Not only that, but what you will make is a 5-carbon compound that gets split into a 3 and a 2, and that 2-carbon compound is a problem because you have to deal with it, which requires energy to do it, to transform it back into something that can feed back into the cycle. I'm not going to get into the particulars of what the intermediates are, but that actually ends up producing CO2 in the process of dealing with that. So that's called that process of bringing in oxygen instead of CO2 and actually producing CO2 as a way of dealing with the wrong intermediate is called photorespiration. Because it's kind of like respiration in the sense that you're taking in O2 and you're giving off CO2. That's the reason it's called that. Well, photorespiration is costly. It doesn't produce any more sugar, but it also spends energy in the form of ATP that would be better directed toward other things. The problem here is that Rubisco has a higher affinity for oxygen than for CO2. So if they're both present, usually oxygen will win out. And this drastically reduces the efficiency of photosynthesis. Now, you might ask, why hasn't something evolved that will not use oxygen, but that uses CO2? And it might just be that it's not all that possible, because it's had a long time to do so. Photosynthesis originated when oxygen was not present in the atmosphere. And so those original Rubisco molecules didn't matter whether they had a high affinity for oxygen, because there just wasn't much there to begin with. So CO2 always won out. Now that O2 has built up in the atmosphere over billions of years of photosynthesis, it's a problem for Rubisco. It reduces its efficiency. But it might be that it just works so well that evolutionarily tweaking with it to reduce the oxygen affinity also reduces the CO2 affinity, and therefore it doesn't work. Well, plants that do this and just have to put up with the fact that every once in a while oxygen comes in instead of CO2 and they have to deal with that, those are called C3 plants, because the first part of that after that hydrolysis of the intermediate is a 3-carbon compound. So they're called C3 plants. We'll talk about some other kinds of plants that deal with photorespiration and therefore have a more efficient mechanism. First, though, let's go to 14. Here we're looking at the thylakoid membrane, which is an inner membrane compared to the outer membrane of the chloroplast. The outer membrane isn't shown just for convenience, but remember the outer membrane is pretty porous, just like the outer membrane of the mitochondrion. Anyway, this is not the thylakoid membrane, this is the inner membrane. Remember, the chloroplast has 3 membranes. So we're outside of the thylakoid, on the right side of this, we're outside of the thylakoid, but we're still inside the chloroplast. We're inside the inner membrane. What is that stuff called? No, matrix is for mitochondria. The stroma, right. So the right side of this, as you see, is the chloroplast stroma. The left side is outside of the chloroplast. So you would normally have an outer membrane as well, which is very porous. That's what's not being shown here. But this is the cytosol side. Okay, so it's just the general compartment within the cell. And in that inner membrane are many copies of a phosphate translocator, as you see in purple here, which is an antiport protein. Remember what that means? Means that it will trade one thing for something else, right? Moves them in opposite directions. Notice that inorganic phosphate gets put into the chloroplast, going to the right in the picture, in exchange for a triose, either glyceraldehyde 3-phosphate or dihydroxyacetone phosphate. Now, do you remember dihydroxyacetone phosphate? That's the other version of the two things that can be created in glycolysis at the fork in the road. And dihydroxyacetone phosphate just gets isomerized into glyceraldehyde 3-phosphate. G3P to continue on. Well, either one of those can be isomerized into each other in a chloroplast as well. So the Calvin cycle produces G3P. One of every six gets spit off. But you can make dihydroxyacetone phosphate out of that. Any one of them can be traded for an inorganic phosphate coming into the chloroplast. The point here, though, on the two sides of the membrane are that two different kinds of compounds are being formed in the different compartments. The triose phosphates that the Calvin cycle produces in the chloroplast are used inside the chloroplast for starch synthesis. Now, starch is what kind of molecule? What kind of polysaccharide? A storage polysaccharide, right. It's the plant's version of glycogen in us, right? So, as you build up triose phosphates, because sunlight is available and you're producing a bunch of triose phosphates via the Calvin cycle, they will be incorporated in, well, you have to take two triose phosphates first to make hexoses. Fructose first, fructose 6-phosphate, then glucose 6-phosphate, glucose 1-phosphate, and then you use ATP, the AMP of ATP, to pick up the glucose into something that's called ADP glucose. Sorry, ADP, not AMP. Anyway, the ADP is carrying the glucose, and this is an activated form of glucose, which can then be stuck on to a bunch of all glucoses that are already stuck together. In other words, a growing starch molecule to make a starch molecule that's one glucose bigger. That's what ADP is doing. It's dropping off another glucose to this growing starch molecule. So that's where starch is formed, inside the chloroplast, in the stroma. And then when it's used, the reverse happens, right? It gets broken down when it's needed for energy. Now, in plants, the starch, which is the storage polysaccharide, is not what gets sent around to different parts of the plant. Plants have what are called transport sugars as well. And they transport the sugar mainly as sucrose, which is a disaccharide, right? That's table sugar. So you have photosynthetic parts of a plant, which are mostly the leaves. They're producing the sugars, but all parts of the plant need the sugar. So you transport that sugar in the form of sucrose from a place where the sugar is being produced to a place where the sugar is needed. A sugar source to a sugar sink. Okay, like the roots, which can't produce their own because they're underground. They have no sunlight. Well, that production of sucrose happens outside the chloroplast, in the cytosol. So because of this translocator, a phosphate coming into the chloroplast will allow triose phosphates to come out, which get converted into the two monosaccharides, fructose and glucose, that you need to combine into sucrose. And that's what gets sent through the tube, the vessels of the plant, to get from one place in the plant to the next. Yeah.
So from the antiport, only the GTP is being transferred, right?
It doesn't have to be G3P. It can also be dihydroxyacetone phosphate, but it's a triose phosphate.
But not the glucose.
Not the glucose, no. No. That's right.